to Inside Investing. In the studio today, we have Gordon Chang of Forbes.com and Jason Voss of the CFA Institute. And we were talking earlier, gentlemen, about how the Chinese government has come under some stress recently, and particularly, you know, how the government mentality may play a role in the future course of you know, these stressors being unpacked. So, guys, if you could unpack for me for a second the difference between managing an economy for ROI, managing for GDP, or managing for God knows what else we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, the Chinese government manages for gross domestic product. They've got a target every year, and this year's target is 7.5%. And for as long as we can remember, they've always exceeded that target. The problem is that because they're doing that, they don't really care about efficiency of investment. So to give you an example, if you go back to about the middle of last decade, about every dollar that new credit that they put into the economy, they got a dollar of output. Today, that number has gone down to 17 cents. So you can imagine they're pouring all this money into the Chinese economy. They're not getting that much back. Now, you can do this for quite a long time, but eventually it catches up with you. And now what we're seeing is it's catching up to the system because they've created so much debt. If you try to give some sort of estimate for the debt that they've got in Chinese society now, it's perhaps 200% of GDP. Some people say 210%. It's probably going to be close to 245, 250% in 2015. We really don't know the full extent of it, but we're talking very big numbers. And so essentially you've got an economy right now which is only growing because the government has been pouring more and more money through the banks and through various other means into the economy. So there's this massive creation of debt. As one economist said, every province in China is a Greece.
So Gordon Chang, who is the end creditor here? If we're talking about who is the person who's lending all this money to China? Is it private investors inside of the province, or is it?
Well, most of the money comes from the central government, one way or another, through the state banks. The state banks used to be just dispersing counters until reform, and now they are supposed to be commercial banks. But they still act on the directions of the central government in Beijing. There is a there's a People's Bank of China, the central bank. There's a Chinese Banking Regulatory Commission, which is nominally the bank regulator. But really, the directions come down from the Politburo Standing Committee, which is the apex of political power in China, because they don't really have independent regulators. You don't have a Federal Reserve in China, for instance. So this is a top-down, politically directed system. They want to keep growth going, and they're doing it at all costs. And now, especially this month, we have seen it catch up with them because there have been these two spikes of interest rates in the interbank markets, two waves of defaults. We've seen at least two central government bill auctions fail this month. These are obvious signs of distress. We have reports that Chinese banks, the smaller ones, are borrowing from loan sharks and are borrowing money at 50% from online microcredit sites. And even the China's largest bank, Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, is in distress. There are reports that this week that they received an emergency bailout from the central government. We don't know if that's true or not, but we do know a lot of other things and that those big banks right now are in real trouble.
And Jason Voss, you're worried about what happens when sort of the social contract that the Chinese government has put in place with their people starts to unravel, and say, you know, sort of in part as a result of these stresses, yeah.
Yeah, my own views differ from Gordon's a little bit. I agree that they manage for GDP, but I think prime in the Chinese government's mind is this social contract, which is essentially that we're going to have a one-party system and an oppressive one at that in exchange for full employment and economic stability. And I think when those things begin to unravel, things get very interesting, and it doesn't look like the Chinese government has too many ways of wiggling out of there. I also want to rewind a little bit on something that was embedded in your initial question, Will, which was managing GDP. And I think that that's exactly what the Chinese government does. And I'm going to offer up a anecdote, which I think is illustrative of exactly that. And that is that the U.S. government, which has a economy which is slightly larger than the Chinese economy, though it has a smaller population, but in many ways is much more complicated. It takes 45 days to close its GDP books at the end of a quarter, and it's revised for many quarters thereafter, whereas the Chinese government, comparable size economy, probably unbelievably complex in particular ways, but even more importantly, a lot of that GDP is undocumented because we're talking about farm land being farmed in very rural parts. Yet they close their books within 10 to 12 days and they revise their GDP twice. And if that's not a managed number or evidence of a managed number, I don't know what it is. And you compare and contrast that GDP figure with some of the pertinent statistics coming out of China, like power usage, which would indicate manufacturing, and you look at things like the producer price index in China, which is also falling. All those things point to a slowing economy, if not already a negative growth economy, yet the GDP number continues to come out positive. So I think it's very mysterious what's going on there, and I think it's anybody's guess, and it has been for a long time, honestly.
It's interesting you mention that because first quarter numbers for China came out on April 15th, so 15 days afterwards. They said 7.7% growth. But if you look at what is by far the most reliable indicator of Chinese economic activity, production of electricity, that was up 2.9% in the quarter. And because the growth of GDP has historically been about 85% of the growth of electricity, you're talking an economy that is about 2.5%. March was the 13th straight month where the producer price index declined. By the way, May, last month, 15th straight month. And the amount of the decline is actually accelerating. So, for instance, in January, PPI was down 1.6, February down 1.6, March down 1.9. You get to April, down 2.6, May down 2.9%. So essentially you have deflation in China because manufacturing is still the biggest sector of the Chinese economy. Now, how can you have 7.7% growth in an economy where you have deflation? That just does not occur in our galaxy.
Well, is there evidence of the astronomical inflation that would seem to indicate? Do you have an estimate of what, the inflation rate may be running at inside of China?
Well, the consumer price index during the period in the first quarter was about 2.1 or so percent. So that's probably understated because they're not counting all of the food inflation. So they got a problem. They got a producer price index, which shows negative numbers, and a consumer price index, which is positive. That's not a good sign either. But essentially, when you look at consumer inflation, they've got an issue because food is a very large portion of that. And that is critical for a population where food is a very large portion of their expenditures. So that is a political issue for China. And when you have unemployment, which they do, the food prices become even more of an issue.
Yeah, I think another thing that bears mentioning is this notion that the inflation is not always captured in CPI here in the United States or otherwise. And I look at the reports of the Chinese ghost towns and ghost airports and ghost train stations as indicative of a particular form of inflation. And I think the most insidious effect of inflation, wherever it occurs, is the destruction of capital. And it's hard not to look at just some of these large complexes in Inner Mongolia and elsewhere throughout China, which are essentially hollow shells of concrete, and not think that there's an inflationary pressure there, regardless of what the statistics say.
Yeah, and going back to the question I asked earlier about, sort of the source of these funds, is the government, when the government undertakes a project, like, say, building a ghost town in, rural Mongolia, right, what pressures are they under in terms of the funding of that? Can they just create the money and pay for it? I mean, to what extent are the capital allocation decisions that are made inside of the government subject to the constraints of reality as they might be otherwise?
Well, all banks in China are under quotas for how much they can lend. But what they have done is they've created a shadow banking system, which is now about 69% of GDP. I mean, just an enormous number. And so a lot of off-the-books financing occurs in the shadow banking system. And that's why, although municipalities are not permitted to borrow, what they have done is they've created these local government financing vehicles, which are basically companies which are owned or controlled by municipalities. They go out and borrow, although they shouldn't be doing this. And so you have this unauthorized economic activity. Now, some people say this is genius, and in some ways it is, getting around very strict central government rules. But on the other hand, it's created a danger because you now have this whole banking system, which is the source of about 45% of credit in China, which is unregulated. And the authorities, of course, know that it exists, but there's not very much they can do about it because it has grown to be this monster. If they were to throttle it, the economy would fall apart immediately, so they can't do that. So you have all sorts of very risky maneuvers are going on. So, for instance, these wealth management products where the banks take their worst loans and they shift them off their balance sheet. This is unbelievably dangerous because these wealth management products go and invest in, for instance, these ghost train stations you talk about, light rail systems, toll roads, which have paybacks that extend years and years, decades even, and yet these WMPs, as they're called, have payment obligations to their investors that are very short-term. So you have very short-term obligations that are being funded by very long-term projects. That mismatch is reckless. And that's the way China has been growing, where essentially the banks have been taking these very, very dangerous loans, putting them off their balance sheets into these wealth management products. And so they go out and invest in these infrastructure projects you've been talking about, and you can see what's going to happen when the music stops. And we're getting to the point where the music is stopping because of various reasons, going back to your point about ROI. These products are investing in projects that won't pay back. They just will not pay back. You know, a ghost city has no customers.
The other thing in terms of the ROI, which often goes unspoken, is that a lot of the incremental growth in China has been generated by financial assets, right, and speculation on financial assets and things like commodities, as opposed to actual things which create industrious possibilities for the future of the country. So I think that China's coming to a place where it's either got to increase the lie and risk its credibility, or you're going to see an outflow of capital or some sort of chaos.
I mean, they've got to maintain confidence, so they are not going to disclose what they've really been doing. They're not going to disclose in how bad a situation they are, because if they do that, foreign investors aren't going to put money in. Once you have that, you've got real problems. China suffered almost immediately when Ben Bernanke, our Federal Reserve Chairman, March 20th or 21st, talked about the possibility of tapering of his quantitative easing program. Well, what happened? All this money left emerging markets, especially those in Asia, and it did the reverse trip across the Pacific. You know, when Bernanke had these QE programs, he said he'd create 600,000 or whatever jobs. Well, yeah, he did, but just not in America. He created them in China and in emerging markets in Asia. And so you saw all that easy money just flow across the Pacific. Now it's going to come back because we've already started to see it last May. We've seen it this month, and that's really affected the Chinese economy, which is one of the factors that have contributed to their liquidity crisis that we have seen so many times this month manifest itself in China. And it's just these little things. You can have the Federal Reserve Chairman slip up in a statement he makes, and he can destroy the Chinese economy.
You know, it's to me, when I was a fund manager, it's that kind of an anecdote that you just shared, Gordon, that was indicative of a very fragile economic situation, right? If the economy is robust, capital is being invested in a robust fashion, returns on capital are good, etc., that kind of a slip-up from the Federal Reserve is discounted quickly and forgotten. And in this instance, it's actually realigned whole swaths of asset classes from commodities to fixed income to equities, which is not a particularly strong argument for a stable economy on sound footing and a strong pricing mechanism, which is sort of inherent in what we're all talking about here.
If you look at the liquidity crisis in China, just to give you another anecdote, some people say that it was started on May 5th. That was the day the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, the foreign exchange regulator, issued a rule that there had to be, they cracked down on what was the fake export invoices. China's been reporting these enormous exports, but everyone knows that they're not real. They basically, exporters have been doing this to try to smuggle money into China and also to get value-added tax rebates. So the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, beginning of May, cracks down on that. That hurt confidence. So immediately after that, about $40 billion left the Chinese banking system. That is not an enormous amount of money, but it had a trickle-on effect. And so what we saw in the beginning of June were the beginning of the liquidity crunches in China. And this is, you know, all you had to have for problems in China, this mighty economy, $8 trillion or so, is that the foreign exchange regulator just insisted that people stop making these, creating these artificial export numbers through fake invoices. That was what triggered the liquidity crisis, as well as Bernanke's comments. And so you see how fragile the Chinese economy is at this moment, where all you have to do is insist on real export transactions, and you sink your own economy. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Well, I mean, it just sort of gets, I mean, we're talking essentially about a train going off the rails here, right? But, you know, I think that, you know, certainly in all the analysis that I've seen on China, you can boil it down to a couple of very simple statements, right? Well, I guess they've got it figured out over there, is what many stateside analysts say about China. Did you see a wide range, you know, before this crisis, before we started, we had a liquidity crisis to talk about, and before we, you know, could point to, you know, the difficulty that actually having to produce real invoices would create in the economy, could you point to a widespread understanding of China?
Well, you know, my own view, these views, and I know Gordon's been talking about these views for many years, and his most explicitly in his book. You know, I think that China is one of those stories like the real estate bubble in the U.S. Everybody knew that, or at least everybody I knew that there was a bubble in the United States. The question wasn't if, it was when. And I think in China, the question is when. And sometimes it's quirky little things like the export numbers being insisted upon, being honest. And you can't predict those things necessarily. And I think that it's without question that capital has been destroyed in China. It's being destroyed on a daily basis, that there's a misallocation of capital in addition because the pricing mechanism is messed up. I think that the way they manage their economy for GDP or for full employment, whatever your argument, is also probably messed up and not sustainable. The question will be, at what point does the market and what point probably do the Chinese themselves lose confidence in this charade? I mean, it's my opinion.
We're seeing a loss of confidence right now. I mean, June was just a really bad month because of that. Just think of it. You know, last week we had the Bank of China, one of the four biggest banks in China, had to issue a statement denying that it had defaulted on its interbank obligations. We have all of these rumors, and I think one of the most interesting ones is Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, the biggest bank in China. It had what it called a systems upgrade to its nationwide ATM system. On Sunday, and a number of cities, the ATMs stopped working. Now, they blamed it on the systems upgrade, but our conversations and our sources say that basically what ICBC did was essentially it was running out of cash, so it just stopped committing withdrawals at its ATMs, and it blamed it on this systems upgrade. People in China now are talking about how this so-called glitch wasn't a glitch, that even the biggest bank in China is having problems. And so this is that moment. You know, in our own situation, you talked about the United States going back before the great downturn. You had Charles Prince, who was then head of Citibank, with that infamous comment that, yeah, you know, as long as the music plays, you've got to get up and dance, so we will dance. And he knew it was coming, but he didn't know when. And so he continued on what was essentially reckless policies because he knew everybody else was doing the same thing. You got the same situation in China. China today has the feel of the United States in 2007. You know the problem is there. You can see why it exists. The economics don't make sense. You just don't know when China is going to get to that point where everything falls apart. I think we've sort of hit it. I think the fuse has been lit. I don't think the regulators and the technocrats have any clue of being able to solve it. They're just watching it. They realize that everything that they can do is going to have worse consequences. So for the most part, I think they're just going to ride it out and hope. But I don't think that that's a real strategy. One of the interesting things about all of this is people who analyze the Chinese economy just hope things will be okay. So for instance, we've seen the People's Bank of China refrain from open market operations, creating a little bit of tight liquidity. And so the question is, well, what's going on here? Well, virtually every analyst is saying, oh, you know, the central bank wants reform, so therefore it is signaling to the weaker banks that the central authorities aren't going to bail you out. This was the narrative that everybody around the world wanted to hear. I thought that that was not right. And indeed, on last Friday, they injected 500 billion yuan into the Chinese market. So clearly the Chinese regulators were not insisting on reform. When they saw the panic, they put more liquidity into the system. They put more liquidity into the system this week as well, which indicates that this whole narrative of reform doesn't make it. They are now so concerned that they are willing to put more liquidity in, even though everybody said they weren't going to do it.
Yeah, now, I mean, is this the kind of thing, I mean, we've seen, you know, the asset prices of Chinese stocks, you know, go down a bit. Yeah, I mean, if we
four-year low is right. Yeah. Today was the four-year low.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, so stocks have sold off, perhaps in reaction to this or perhaps because of deteriorating fundamentals. But, you know, when you talk about sort of the international effects that a slowdown in China might have, how is this going to manifest itself stateside?
Panic. panic in the financial markets. I mean, we shouldn't panic, but of course that's going to happen. Just look what happened on April 15th. April 15th, we said, you know, that was the day that the National Bureau of Statistics announced the first quarter GDP number. It came in at 7.7. Analysts, and I have no idea why they thought this, but most analysts thought 8.0. So what happens? The Dow drops 266 points that day. Now, that was also the day of the Boston bombing, but by the time of the bombing, the market was already down more than 160 points. And so, you know, this is essentially 160 points gets wiped off the Dow because China reports 7.7% growth instead of 8.0. If you knew what was going on in the Chinese economy, you would not have been fazed by 7.7. You would have just shrugged it off. But we believe that China is this engine of global growth, and so therefore, anytime there's a problem in China, it's going to affect our markets. And so you have this sell-off, which started in Asia, went to Europe, and ended up in the Dow on the 15th. But the more we know about how bad the Chinese economy is and how unimportant, in some senses, China is, then we're not going to have the financial panic. The one thing about China is, yes, for 35 years, had a lot of growth, but it was not the engine of global growth. Because to be an engine of global growth, you got to buy the exports of other countries so that they have manufacturing there. China, through its predatory manufacturing policies and other subsidies, was taking growth from other nations. So while China had a lot of growth, it was not an engine of global growth. We're still the engine of global growth, which shows you how bad the rest of the world is. But the point is, as long as we understand what's going on in China and how unimportant China is to our economy, we'll be okay. Because when the Chinese economy falls apart, which it will, we're going to say, oh, well. But if we misunderstand our relationship with China, we will panic, and that panic in the financial markets will have an effect in our real economy.
Yeah, my own personal view, I've done some research on this, and Gordon, you touched on it tangentially. The Chinese are not massive importers from the rest of the world. They actually don't touch most of the rest of the world at that hard asset level. It's mostly at a financial level that China touches the rest of the globe, and I'm on the record as saying that I think that the small to medium-term effects would probably be large and mostly financial. You'd see a huge sell-off and readjustment in many of the financial markets. But I think that the long-term actually would probably be good for China. It'd probably be good for the rest of the globe, too, to orient towards the truth and all honesty.
Yeah. I mean, just one other thing. You talk about the financial effects. You know, for seven calendar quarters, China has not increased its holdings of U.S. Treasury debt. They've stayed same since July 2011 at about $1.3 trillion. Those are the official numbers. There's no reason to believe that the unofficial holdings of treasuries is any different. Essentially, China has not been funding our deficits. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't believe in deficit spending. But the point is, we do not need China to fund ourselves because for the last seven quarters, we've been doing okay. You know, we've been able to fund our deficit spending without China. So this is another thing. You know, people say, oh, you know, China goes in the tank. How are we going to fund our federal deficit? Well, we're going to be just fine.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, because one of the things that China will have to manage is its own portfolio of U.S. treasuries, and they can't allow that to collapse, in all honesty. That would be a double whammy for their economy. The other thing, too, is that Chinese goods would probably become cheaper in a particular way, which is good for U.S. consumers and European consumers in particular. So I'm not arguing that this is a good thing for the economy, but I think they're mitigating factors, and I think that the worry is probably overblown, and it's that classic madness of crowds kind of worry that is in place.
So, you know, as we sort of sprint towards the conclusion here, the one thing that keeps coming up in my mind is, you know, China has spent a lot of money on building a lot of stuff. You know, and when Michael Lewis was writing about the housing crisis in the U.S., he had this great quip, which is, you know, the one great thing is that we have a lot of new houses. and, you know, they're pretty nice. And, you know, here in the U.S., we have this memory of, you know, sort of the works, you know, whatever, the works, the WPA, whatever the acronym stands for, that built, you know, the Hoover Dam and all of these other great things. I mean, is there a chance that this massive capital investment in the long term for China is going to work out well, or is it the kind of thing where a lot of money has been set on fire?
I think a lot of money has been
set on fire because you got to pay for it. You know, it's sort of like if you're asking, can China use these enormous airports? Like, for instance, the Beijing Airport, Terminal 3, biggest building in the world, beautiful. But the point is they've got to pay for it. They've got to pay for it now, and they're not able to do it because it's not just the Beijing Terminal 3. It's all of these airports across China, all of these railroad stations, high-speed rail lines to nowhere. They've got to pay for it, and that debt is just enormous. We don't really know how much debt they have because they've hidden away a lot of it. They've got the shadow banking. It is just very difficult to understand. But the point is, it's somewhere probably north of 200% of GDP. You know, people are going to want their money back. And they're going to want their money back before, you know, the 30 years or so. So the problem is they've got a here and now issue of being able to service their debt. They're creating debt faster than their ability to service it. That never works in any economy, even in something like China's.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of anecdotal evidence coupled with quantitative analysis. And I read a blurb in, I believe, the South China Morning Post last week from a real estate developer, commercial real estate developer in Shanghai, and they asked him what his solution would be if, in fact, the Chinese economy collapses. What would you do with all these empty pieces of real estate? And he said, well, we would have to get rid of them. And the reporter said, to be clear, are you saying that you would knock them down? He said, how else would you get rid of them?
Creates GDP when you get rid of them.
Kind of like a funeral home creates GDP when somebody dies.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. Jason Voss, CFA Institute, Gordon Chang, Forbes.com. This is Inside Investing. Thank you.